intact. Old Gus was a pretty sound sleeper, I guess. According to Swanson, Augustus Seward and George Robinson then jointly battled Powell, which we already know directly contradicts the sworn testimony of both of them. That fight supposedly spilled over into the hallway outside of Seward's room. At the time, Seward's wife, alarmed by Fanny's screams, emerged from her third-floor back bedroom in time to witness the climax of the hallway struggle between Powell and her son, Gus. Uncomprehending, she assumed that her husband had become delirious and was running amok. Fred's wife, Anna, rushed to the scene, unquote. Apparently, Francis and Anna Seward slept even more soundly than Augustus. With their arrival, though, Powell was outnumbered 6-1, and that didn't even include Hansel, who, according to Swanson, decided that his best bet was to get out of Dodge. Quote, on Powell's way out, he caught up with Emmerich Hansel, who was running down the staircase, trying to stay ahead of the assassin. The State Department messenger, on duty at Seward's home, was fleeing rather than joining the battle, unquote. Of course he was. That's probably why we all remember him being lynched, which is undoubtedly what would have happened if Swanson's tall tale was true. I guess Hansel slept through most of the ordeal as well, foolishly choosing to flee at the same time as Powell. You would think that he would have just stayed wherever it was that he was hiding, or run sooner, but those would have been safer options. But then again, since he had a gun and was backed up by at least 6 people, and the assailant was unarmed, maybe he should have just done his job. That way, he wouldn't have had to haul his gravely wounded body up 2 flights of stairs to get into bed before the doctor got there. It is more than a little odd, I must say, that both Augustus Seward and Francis Seward claimed to initially believe that the intruder was actually William Seward running amok. Was that a common thing for the Secretary of State to do, even when everyone knew that he was confined to bed and completely immobile? Mr. Robinson, by the way, had a change of heart after telling a reporter about the intruder with light sandy hair, whiskers, and a mustache. By the time the trial rolled around just a few weeks later, Robinson was sure that Powell was the assailant. That may have been due to the fact that he received a gold medal, $5,000 in cash, and a promotion. And he later was awarded the knife allegedly used by Powell in the attack. And there's a photograph here of a gentleman holding a skull, which is said to be the only known remains of Lewis Powell. It is impossible for me to believe that the alleged events at the Seward home ever took place. All of the available evidence overwhelmingly suggests that it was an entirely manufactured affair. Fanny and Francis Seward, as previously discussed, did not live long after the alleged attack. Neither, of course, did Lewis Powell. William and Frederick Seward chose to never speak publicly about the alleged incident. Augustus Seward, George Robinson, William Bell, and belatedly, Emmerich Hansel, gave wildly conflicting accounts. And as mainstream historians continue to work diligently to bend the conflicting accounts into some kind of believable storyline, the story just gets more and more ridiculous. The more deeply immersed in this I become, the more I'm convinced that the key to understanding the Lincoln assassination may be in understanding what didn't happen at the Seward residence. For if the alleged parallel attack on the Sewards never took place, then clearly there was much more to the events of April 14, 1865, than the activities of John Wilkes Booth and a ragtag band of conspirators. Before wrapping up, let's take a look at one final curiosity surrounding the alleged attack on the Seward family. In all of the accounts that I have read, and I've now worked my way through 14 books chronicling the Lincoln assassination, it is either stated or implied that Powell and Bell ascended just one flight of stairs to get to William Seward's bedroom and descended just one flight to exit the house. But Seward's bedroom was on the 3rd floor of the home, which meant that reaching him and Frederick and the rest of the cast would have required first ascending one flight of stairs, then crossing a 2nd floor landing, and then ascending a 2nd flight of stairs. That curious fact seems to have remained deliberately obscured for many, many years now, and it's not hard to figure out why. For if that fact is pointed out, it raises the very obvious question of exactly how Powell would have known to bypass the home's 2nd floor and proceed directly to the 3rd. And that brings us to an end of Part 8 of Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination is Wrong by David McGowan. Once again, head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, hit the Features tab and jump down to Lincoln and pick up with us next time in Part 9. Thanks again, as always, for joining me, guys. You've been listening to the Pure Grace Podcast. Thanks again for joining me. I look forward to catching you again next time. Take care.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today, we're going to pick up in Part 9 of Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination is Wrong by David McGowan. As always, head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, hit the Features tab and jump down to Lincoln. Pick up with us right here in Part 9. Let's jump right in. If there's anything that we can be certain about in regard to the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln, it is that we will never know what really happened in the presidential box at Ford's Theater at approximately 10:15 p.m. on the night of April 14, 1865. in addition to the guy who made a hasty exit across the stage and out the back door, and the guy who caught a bullet in the head and never regained consciousness, there were, depending on which version of events one chooses to believe, either 3 or 4 eyewitnesses present in that box that fateful evening. Mary Todd Lincoln was certainly there, as were Major Henry Rathbone and his fiancée and stepsister, Clara Harris. By some accounts, including Forbes' own account, presidential aide Charles Forbes was there as well. The Lincoln party had arrived at the theater around 8:30 p.m., about a half an hour after the play entitled Our American Cousin had begun. The show was briefly halted while the band played Hail to the Chief, accompanied by a rousing ovation from the crowd, after which the Lincolns and their guests quietly took their seats and the play resumed. Some 2 hours later, the president lay mortally wounded with a lead ball lodged in his brain. Of the 4 potential eyewitnesses, none were ever questioned by reporters. Only one was ever questioned by authorities. Only one was ever deposed. Only one was ever called upon to testify what he or she witnessed that evening. Only one ever spoke publicly in any way about what exactly transpired in that box. Despite the fact that the Lincoln assassination was billed as the crime of the century, authorities seemed to have no interest at all in speaking with the handful of people who actually witnessed the event. As for Mary Todd Lincoln, the only words of hers that were ever made public concerning the death of her husband were from a personal letter that she sent to an Edward Lewis Baker Jr. in 1877, 12 years after the assassination, and those strangely punctuated words shed no light at all on the events of that evening. Quote, God gives us our beloved ones. We make them our idols. They are removed from us, and we have patiently to await the time when He reunites us to them, and the waiting is so long. My bereavements have been so intense, the most loving and devoted of husbands, torn from my side, my hand within his own, at the time, and God has recalled from this earth sons, the most idolizing, the noblest, purest, most talented, that were ever given to parents, their presence grand and beautiful, too good for this world, so full of sorrow, yet the time will come when the severance will be over, together husband, wife, and children, never more to be separated. I grieve for those who have been called upon to give up their precious ones, and until the sunlight of a happier clime dawns upon us, we will never know until then why we have been visited by such sorrow. End quote. Clara Harris was similarly tight-lipped about what she witnessed at Ford's Theater. Her account also comes from personal correspondence, this one written on April 29, 1865, just 2 weeks after the tragedy. Quote, that terrible Friday night to me is yet almost like some dreadful vision. We 4 composed the party that evening. They drove out to our door in the gayest spirits, chatting our way, and the president was received with the greatest enthusiasm. They say that we were watched by the assassins, as we alighted from the carriage. Oh, how anyone could be so cruel as to strike that kind, dear, honest face. And when I think of that fiend, barring himself in alone with us, my blood runs cold. My dress is saturated with blood. My hands and face were covered. You may imagine what a scene. And so, all through that dreadful night, when we stood by that dying bed, poor Miss Lincoln was, and is, almost crazy. Henry narrowly escaped with his life. The knife struck at his heart with all the force of a practiced and powerful arm. He fortunately parried the blow and received a wound in his arm, extending along the bone from the elbow nearly to the shoulder. He concealed it for some time, but was finally carried home in swoon. The loss of blood had been so great from an artery and veins severed. He is now getting quite well, but cannot as yet use his arm. Unquote. It wasn't until almost 30 years after the assassination that Charles Forbes swore out an affidavit. Unfortunately, that affidavit also fails to shed any light at all on the events of that evening. Quote, I was the personal attendant of the late President Lincoln from shortly after his first inauguration up until the time he fell by the assassin's bullet. I accompanied him in the carriage, was with him from the carriage to the box in the theater, and was in the box when the assassin fired his fatal shot. Curious that nearly 3 decades after John Wilkes Booth was identified as the assassin, Forbes referred to him merely as, quote, the assassin. And that, dear readers, is the sum total of what we have from 3 of the 4 eyewitnesses. Considering once again that this was, as I may have mentioned, the crime of the century, that is a rather remarkable set of circumstances. That leaves us with only the tale told by Major Henry Rathbone, which we already know was a hopelessly scripted, rehearsed affair that he told under oath in almost exactly the same words on no less than 3 occasions. And yet it is the only account we have, the only account that we will ever have. So we must look at it in its entirety, as originally told at his April 17, 1865 deposition. It is a strange tale, to be sure, and it would indicate that Rathbone spent more time studying the physical characteristics of the room than he did watching the play. Quote, "The box assigned to the president is in the second tier, on the right-hand side of the audience, and was occupied by the president and Mrs. Lincoln, Miss Harris, and by this deponent, and by no other person. The box is entered by passing from the front of the building in the rear of the dress circle to a small entry or passageway about 8 feet in length and 4 feet in width. This passageway is entered by a door which opens on the inner side. This door is placed as to make an acute angle between it and the wall behind it on the inner side. At the inner end of this passageway is another door standing squarely across and opening into the box. On the left-hand side of the passageway, and very near the inner end, is a third door which also opens into the box. This latter door was closed. The party entered the box through the door at the end of the passageway. The box is so constructed that it may be divided in two by a movable partition, one of the doors described opening into each. The front of the box is about 10 or 12 feet in length, and in the center of the railing is a small pillar overhung with a curtain. The depth of the box from front to rear is about 9 feet. The elevation of the box above the stage, including the railing, is about 10 or 12 feet. When the party entered the box, a cushioned armchair was standing at the end of the box furthest from the stage and nearest the audience. This was also the nearest point to the door from which the box is entered. The president seated himself in this chair, and, except that he once left the chair for the purpose of putting on his overcoat, remained so until he was shot. Mrs. Lincoln was seated in a chair between the president and the pillar in the center, above described. At the opposite end of the box, that nearest the stage, were two chairs. In one of these, standing in the corner, Miss Harris was seated. At her left hand, and along the wall running from that end of the box to the rear, stood a small sofa. At the end of this sofa, next to Miss Harris, this deponent was seated, and the president, as they were sitting, was about 7 or 8 feet, and the distance between this deponent and the door was about the same. The distance between the president as he sat and the door was about 4 or 5 feet. The door, according to the recollections of this deponent, was not closed during the evening. When the second scene of the third act was being performed, and while this deponent was intently viewing the proceedings upon the stage, with his back toward the door, he had heard a discharge of a pistol behind him, and looking around, saw through the smoke a man standing between the door and the president. At the same time, deponent heard him shout some word which deponent thinks was freedom. This deponent instantly sprang toward him and seized him. He wrested himself from the grasp and made a violent thrust at the breast of this deponent with a large knife. Deponent parried the blow by striking it up and received a wound several inches deep in his left arm between the elbow and the shoulder. The orifice of the wound is about 1.5 inches in length and extends upwards toward the shoulder several inches. The man rushed to the front of the box and Deponent endeavored to seize him again, but only caught his clothes as he was leaping over the railing of the box. The clothes, as this Deponent believes, were torn in this attempt to seize him. As he went over upon the stage, Deponent cried out with a loud voice, "Stop that man!" Deponent then turned to the president. His position was not changed. His head was slightly bent forward, and his eyes were closed. Deponent saw that he was unconscious and, supposing him mortally wounded, rushed to the door for the purpose of calling medical aid. On reaching the outer door of the passageway as above described, Deponent found it barred by a heavy piece of plank, one end of which secured in the wall and the other resting against the door. It had been so securely fastened that it required considerable force to remove it. This wedge or bar was about 4 feet from the floor. Persons upon the outside were beating against the door for the purpose of entering. Deponent removed the bar, and the door was opened. Several persons who represented themselves to be surgeons were allowed to enter. Deponent saw there Colonel Crawford and requested him to prevent other persons from entering the box. Deponent then returned to the box and found the surgeon examining the president's person. They had not yet discovered the wound. As soon as it was discovered, it was determined to remove him from the theater. While he was carried out, this deponent then proceeded to assist Mrs. Lincoln, who was intensely excited, to leave the theater. On reaching the head of the stairs, deponent requested Major Potter to aid him in assisting Mrs. Lincoln across the street to the house which the president was being conveyed. The wound which the deponent had received had been bleeding profusely, and on reaching the house, feeling very faint from the loss of blood, he seated himself in the hall and soon after fainted away and was laid upon the floor. Upon the return of consciousness, Deponent was taken in the carriage to his residence. In review of this transaction, it is the confident belief of this Deponent that the time which elapsed between the discharge of the pistol and the time when the assassin leaped from the box did not exceed 30 seconds. Neither Mrs. Lincoln nor Miss Harris had left their seats. Rathbone's deposition and subsequent testimony were given at a time when attorneys did not have the luxury of submitting photographic evidence to set the scene for jurors. It appears then that prosecutors used this detailed physical description to paint a mental image for those in the courtroom, and it was very hard to believe that Rathbone would have spontaneously offered up such testimony. Those details were undoubtedly provided to him as part of the script he appears to have been following. Now let's look at all the other reasons why Rathbone's account is seriously lacking in credibility. First of all, he claims that the alleged assailant was in the box for up to 30 seconds after shooting Lincoln, long enough to grapple with and seriously wound Rathbone. But the accounts of other witnesses in the theater that evening directly contradict that notion. A witness identified only as Bassett, for instance, claimed that a second after the shot was fired, a man vaulted over the baluster of the box. Witness Frederick Sawyer wrote that the whole occurrence, the shot, the leap, the escape, was all done while you could count to eight. Actor Harry Hawke, after describing the sequence of events, claimed that the above all occurred in the space of a few seconds, and at the time I did not know that the president was shot. How then was there time for the alleged struggle with Rathbone? And if Rathbone had been grappling with an assailant, as said assailant was leaping over the front railing, as Rathbone claimed, those actions would have been visible to many of the witnesses in the theater. And yet none of the witnesses who claimed to see the man leap from the box mentioned seeing him struggle with Rathbone either before or while doing so. Another problem is that Rathbone claims to have suffered a substantial wound that bled profusely, so much so that his fiancée allegedly found herself drenched in blood, and yet all of the witnesses who said they saw the fleeing man prominently brandish a large knife as he made his exit across the stage, not one of them mentioned seeing any blood on that knife, or on the man's hands, or on his clothing. How is it possible that he could have cut Rathbone so severely and then continued grappling with him and yet walked away with no visible blood on him? Yet another minor problem is that neither Rathbone nor his fiancée made any mention of his very serious wound ever being treated. He claimed that the wound was so severe that he passed out from blood loss, but that he was merely taken home and dropped off. According to the official story, there were at least three skilled surgeons on hand, none of whom could really do much for the mortally wounded Lincoln. Why then didn't anyone bother to attend such a grave wound inflicted on a guest of the president? From what I hear, those severed arteries can be a real killer if left unattended. What we seem to have here is a situation in which, A, witness accounts don't allow for enough time for Rathbone to have been seriously wounded, B, Rathbone never received treatment for a serious wound, C, the knife that allegedly inflicted the wound was bloodless just seconds later, as was the guy carrying it, and D, none of the self-proclaimed witnesses in the theater that night saw Rathbone grappling with his alleged assailant. Moving on to other peculiarities in Rathbone's account, one obvious question that is raised is, why would John Wilkes Booth or anyone else entering the box for the purpose of killing Lincoln in the manner in which it occurred take the time to wedge the outer door shut? Any pursuers weren't going to come from that direction, and if the alleged plan went awry, the assailant might need to flee in that direction. So why cut off a possible means of escape? And how is it that a sturdy wood plank of the same precise length needed to do the job just happened to be on hand? Those are questions that historians have never really provided satisfactory answers to. According to Rathbone's account, the inner door of the box was open all night. How then would the party not have heard an intruder enter the outer door and then close it and forcibly wedge it shut before sneaking up behind the president? It doesn't seem possible for an uninvited intruder to have done that. And there was no reason to do it. Booth, it will be recalled, was ludicrously armed with a single-shot Derringer. The plan, therefore, was heavily dependent upon the element of surprise. Why then risk discovery by pointlessly wedging the door shut? Who then really wedged that door shut, and why? Did it benefit the alleged assailant, or did it provide a window of opportunity to stage the scene before any responders could get to the president? Several other questions are raised by Rathbone's account, including why the president was seated furthest from the stage and closest to the door. Wouldn't the guest of honor customarily get the best seat in the house? Why had the furniture in the box that day been arranged to place him furthest from the stage? And being that he was the fourth member of the party, why didn't Rathbone sit in the fourth chair along the front of the box? Why did he choose instead to sit alone on a sofa, slightly behind the others? Beyond the problems with Rathbone's account, there are other problems with the official story of what went down in Ford's Theater on April 14, 1865. According to witness accounts, the man fleeing across the stage brandished his knife in his right hand, indicating that he was right-handed. But the bullet that killed Lincoln, purportedly fired by an assailant standing behind him, entered behind his left ear and traveled diagonally through the brain cavity, ending up behind his right eye. That would be a rather tricky shot to pull off for a right-hander. To the extent that historians have addressed this anomaly, it is generally claimed that Lincoln turned his head just as the shot was fired. But that is purely speculation aimed at bringing the known facts of the case in line with the official story. According to all the early witness accounts, events played out very quickly and the suspect was across the stage and out of the building before anyone realized what had happened. It was only then, when it was too late to apprehend the suspect, that Mary Lincoln's anguished cries from the box could be heard, along with Rathbone's futile exhortations to stop the fleeing suspect.